You've found Spider on the Web, and we'll talk in a minute. But first, here's Vancouver composer Shaun Tozer. Greetings, old friend, or welcome, stranger, or cyber-drunk who wandered in out of the data rain, as the case might be. You're listening to Spider on the Web number 61, my first podcast of the new year. In this episode, I'll be reading you one of the great John Varley's lesser-known stories, and, if there's time, an essay of my own from nearly 30 years ago about a writer I'm fond of. But first, here's another track from Shaun Tozer. If you were fortunate enough to catch the superb Chris Haddock TV series Intelligence during the 3 seasons it lasted before being foully slain by chicken shit choke chain chair warmers at CBC, you know Shaun's work. He did the music for the series throughout. His knowledge is so broad and so deep that in the course of a few minutes he can wander in and out of half a dozen different musical styles without even seeming to realize it. He doesn't so much make them work together as realize they always did. Here's an example from the CD demo reel he sends around the TV and film industry to line up gigs. I wish I could tell you the title of this track.
Thank you.
To learn more about Shaun Tozer's music and how to score some, visit shauntozer.com. That's spelled all one word, S-C-H-A-U-N-T-O-Z-E-R. Okay, 5 or 6 years ago, I had the great honor of being asked to contribute to an anthology of science fiction stories inspired by the songs of the immortal Janis Ian, of whom I've been a major fan since her Society's Child first hit the radio, way back in the Stone Age. I found myself in excellent company in that anthology. Janis and co-editor Mike Resnick managed to corral stories from 28 of the finest science fiction writers alive, all of whom turned out to be Janis Ian fans. You can tell because each of them produced some of their best work for this occasion. Here's one of my favorites, a darkly humorous little piece by my friend and colleague John Varley, called In Fading Suns and Dying Moons. Within the memories of our lives gone by, afraid to die, we learned to lie and measure out the time in coffee spoons, in fading suns and dying moons. From Aftertones by Janis Ian. The first time they came through the neighborhood, there really wasn't much neighborhood to speak of. Widely dispersed hydrogen molecules, only 2 or 3 per cubic meter. Traces of heavier elements from long-ago supernovas. The usual assortment of dust particles at a density of 1 particle every cubic mile or so. The dust was mostly ammonia, methane, and water ice, with some more complex molecules like benzene. Here and there, these thin ingredients were pushed into eddies by light pressure from neighboring stars. Somehow they set forces in motion. I picture it as a cosmic finger stirring the mix, out in the interstellar wastes where space is really flat in the Einsteinian sense, making a whirlpool in the unimaginable cold. Then they went away. 4 billion years later, they returned. Things were brewing nicely. The space debris had congealed into a big burning central mass and a series of rocky or gaseous globes, all sterile, in orbit around it. They made a few adjustments and planted their seeds and saw that it was good. They left a small observer recorder behind, along with a thing that would call them when everything was ripe. Then they went away again. 1 billion years later, the timer went off, and they came back. I had a position at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, but of course I had not gone to work that day. I was sitting at home watching the news, as frightened as anyone else. Martial law had been declared a few hours earlier. Things had been getting chaotic. I'd heard gunfire from the streets outside. Someone pounded on my door. "United States Army!" someone shouted. "Open the door immediately!" I went to the door, which had 4 locks on it. "How do I know you're not a looter?" I shouted. "Sure, I am authorized to break your door down. Open the door or stand clear." I put my eye to the old-fashioned peephole. They were certainly dressed like soldiers. One of them raised his rifle and slammed the butt down on my doorknob. I shouted that I would let them in, and in a few seconds I had all the locks open. 6 men in full combat gear hustled into my kitchen. They split up and quickly explored all 3 rooms of the apartment, shouting out, "All clear!" in brisk military voices. 1 man, a bit older than the rest, stood facing me with a clipboard in his hand. "Sir, are you Dr. Andrew Richard Lewis?" "There's been some mistake," I said. "I'm not a medical doctor." "Sir, are you a doctor?" "Yes, yes, I'm Andy Lewis. What can I do for you?" "Sir, I am Captain Edgar, and I am ordered to induct you into the United States Army Special Invasion Corps, effective immediately at the rank of second lieutenant. Please raise your right hand and repeat after me." I knew from the news that this was now legal, and I had the choice of enlisting or facing a long prison term. I raised my hand, and in no time at all I was a soldier. "Lieutenant, your orders are to come with me. You have 15 minutes to pack what essentials you may need, such as prescription, medicine, and personal items. My men will help you assemble your gear." I nodded, not trusting myself to speak. "You may bring any items related to your specialty, laptop, computer, reference books." He paused, apparently unable to imagine what a man like me would want to bring along to do battle with space aliens. "Captain, do you know what my specialty is?"
"My understanding is that you are a bug specialist."
"An entomologist, Captain, not an exterminator. Could you give me any clue as to why I'm needed?"
For the first time, he looked less than totally self-assured. Lieutenant, all I know is... they're collecting butterflies. They hustled me to a helicopter. We flew low over Manhattan. Every street was gridlocked. All the bridges were completely jammed with mostly abandoned cars. I was taken to an air base in New Jersey and hurried onto a military jet transport that stood idling on the runway. There were a few others already on board. I knew most of them. Entomology is not a crowded field. The plane took off at once. There was a colonel aboard whose job was to brief us on our mission and on what was thus far known about the aliens. Not much was really known that I hadn't already seen on television. They had appeared simultaneously on seacoasts worldwide. One moment there was nothing. The next moment there was a line of aliens as far as the eye could see. In the Western Hemisphere, the line stretched from Point Barrow in Alaska to Tierra del Fuego in Chile. Africa was lined from Tunis to the Cape of Good Hope. So were the western shores of Europe, from Norway to Gibraltar, Australia, Japan, Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and every other island thus far contacted reported the same thing. A solid line of aliens appearing in the west, moving east. Aliens? No one knew what else to call them. They were clearly not of planet Earth, though if you ran into a single one, there would be little reason to think them very odd. Just millions and millions of perfectly ordinary people dressed in white coveralls, blue baseball caps, and brown boots, within arm's reach of each other, walking slowly toward the east. Within a few hours of their appearance, someone on the news had started calling it the Line, and the creatures who were in it, linemen. From the pictures on television, they appeared rather average and androgynous.
"They're not human," the colonel said. "Those coveralls, it looks like they don't come off. The hats, either. You get close enough, you can see it's all part of their skin."
"Predictive coloration," said Watkins, a colleague of mine from the museum. "Many insects adopt colors or shapes to blend with their environment."
"What's the point of blending in?" I asked, "if you are made so conspicuous by your actions?"
"Perhaps the fitting in is simply to look more like us. It seems unlikely, doesn't it, that evolution would have made them look like janitors," somebody piped up.
The colonel was frowning at us.
"You think they're insects?"
"Not by any definition I've ever heard," Watkins said. "Of course, other animals adapt to their surroundings, too. Arctic foxes in winter coats, tigers with their stripes, chameleons." The colonel mulled this for a moment, then resumed his pacing.
"Whatever they are, bullets don't bother them. There have been many instances of civilians shooting at the aliens."
Soldiers, too, I thought. I'd seen film of it on television, a National Guard unit in Oregon cutting loose with their rifles. The aliens hadn't reacted at all, not visibly, until all the troops and all their weapons just vanished without the least bit of fuss, and the line moved on. We landed at a disused-looking airstrip somewhere in Northern California. We were taken to a big motel which the Army had taken over. In no time, I was hustled aboard a large Coast Guard helicopter with a group of soldiers, a squad, a platoon, I don't know, led by a young lieutenant who looked even more terrified than I felt. On the way to the line, I learned that his name was Evans and that he was in the National Guard. It had been made clear to me that I was in charge of the overall mission and Evans was in charge of the soldiers. Evans said his orders were to protect me. How he was to protect me from aliens who were immune to his weapons hadn't been spelled out. My own orders were equally vague. I was to land close behind the line, catch up, and find out everything I could.
"They speak better English than I do," the colonel had said. "We must know their intentions. Above all, you must find out why they're collecting..."
And here his composure almost broke down, but he took a deep breath and steadied himself.
"Collecting butterflies," he finished.
We passed over the line at a few hundred feet. Directly below us, individual aliens could be made out, blue hats and white shoulders. But off to the north and south, it quickly blurred into a solid white line, vanishing into the distance, as if one of those devices that make chalk lines on football fields had gone mad. Evans and I watched it. None of the linemen looked up at the noise. They were walking slowly, all of them, never getting more than a few feet apart. The terrain was grassy, rolling hills dotted here and there with clumps of trees. No man-made structures were in sight.
The pilot put us down 100 yards behind the line. "I want you to keep your men at least 50 yards away from me," I told Evans. "Are those guns loaded? Do they have those safety things on them? Good. Please keep them on. I'm almost as afraid of being shot by one of those guys as I am of whatever they are." And I started off alone toward the line. How does one address a line of marching alien creatures? "Take me to your leader" seemed a bit peremptory. "Hey, bro, what's happening?" perhaps overly familiar. In the end, after following for 15 minutes at a distance of about 10 yards, I had settled on "excuse me," so I moved closer and cleared my throat. Turns out that was enough. One of the linemen stopped walking and turned to me. This close, one could see that his features were rudimentary. His head was like a mannequin or a wig stand, a nose, hollows for eyes, bulges for cheeks. All the rest seemed to be painted on. I could only stand there idiotically for a moment. I noticed a peculiar thing. There was no gap in the line. I suddenly remembered why it was me and not some diplomat standing there. "Now, why are you collecting butterflies?" I asked.
"Why not?"
he said, and I figured it was going to be a long, long day.
"You should have no trouble understanding," he said. "Butterflies are the most beautiful things on your planet, aren't they?"
I've always thought so, wondering, did he know I was a lepidopterist?
"Then there you are."
Now he began to move. The lion was about 20 yards away, and through our whole conversation he never let it get more distant than that. We walked at a leisurely 1 mile per hour. "Okay," I told myself, "try to keep it to butterflies. Leave it to the military types to get to the tough questions. When do you start kidnapping our children, raping our women, and frying us for lunch?" "What are you doing with them?"
"Harvesting them."
He extended a hand toward the line, and, as if summoned, a lovely specimen of Adelpha brodoii fluttered toward him. He did something with his fingers, and a pale blue sphere formed around the butterfly.
"Isn't it lovely?"
he asked, and I moved in for a closer look. He seemed to treasure these wonderful creatures I'd spent my life studying. He made another gesture, and the blue ball with the Adelpha disappeared. "What happens to them?" I asked him.
"There is a collector,"
he said. "A lepidopterist?"
"No, it's a storage device. You can't see it because it is off to one side."
"Off to one side of what?" I wondered, but didn't ask. "And what happens to them in the collector?"
"They are put in storage in a place where time does not move, where time does not pass, where they do not move through time as they do here."
He paused for a few seconds.
It is difficult to explain."
"Off to one side?" I suggested.
"Exactly. Excellent. Off to one side of time. You've got it."
I had nothing, actually, but I plowed on. "What will become of them?"
"We're building a place. Our leader wishes it to be a very special place. Therefore, we are making it of these beautiful creatures."
"Of butterfly wings?"
"They will not be harmed. We know ways of making walls in a manner that will allow them to fly freely."
I wished someone had given me a list of questions. "How did you get here? How long will you stay?"
"A certain length of time. Not a great length by your standards."
"What about your standards?"
"By our standards, no time at all. As to how we got here, have you read a book entitled Flatland?"
"I'm afraid not."
"Pity,"
he said, and turned away and vanished. Our operation in Northern California was not the only group trying desperately to find out more about the linemen, of course. There were lines on every continent, and soon they would be present in every nation. They had covered many small Pacific islands in only a day, and when they reached the eastern shores, they simply vanished, as my guide had. News media were doing their best to pool information. I believe I got a lot of those facts before the general population, since I had been shanghaied into the forefront, but our information was often as garbled and inaccurate as what the rest of the world was getting. The military was scrambling around in the dark just like everyone else. But we learned some things.
They were collecting moths, as well as butterflies, from the drabbest specimen to the most gloriously colored, the entire order Lepidoptera. They could appear and vanish at will. It was impossible to get a count of them. Whenever one stopped to commune with the natives, as mine had, the line remained solid, with no gaps. When they were through talking to you, they simply went where the Cheshire Cat went, leaving behind not even a grin. Wherever they appeared, they spoke the local language, fluently and idiomatically. This was true even in isolated villages in China or Turkey or Nigeria, where some dialects were used by only a few hundred people. They didn't seem to weigh anything at all. Moving through forests, the line became more of a wall, linemen appearing in literally every tree, on every limb, walking on branches obviously too thin to bear their weight and not even causing them to bend. When the tree had been combed for butterflies, the crews vanished and appeared in another tree. Walls meant nothing to them. In cities and towns, nothing was missed, not even closed bank vaults, attic spaces, closets. They didn't come through the door, they simply appeared in a room and searched it. If you were on the toilet, that was just too bad. Anytime they were asked where they came from, they mentioned that book, Flatland. Within hours, the book was available on hundreds of websites. Downloads ran to the millions. The full title of the book was Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions. It was supposedly written by one Mr. A. Square, a resident of Flatland, but its actual author was Edwin Abbott, a 19th-century cleric and amateur mathematician. A copy was waiting for me when we got back to camp after that first frustrating day. The book is an allegory and a satire, but also an ingenious way to explain the concept of multidimensional worlds to the layman, like me. Mr. Square lives in a world of only two dimensions. For him, there is no such thing as up or down, only forward, backward, and side to side. It is impossible for us to really see from Square's point of view a single line that extends all around him with nothing above it or below it. Nothing. Not empty space, not a black or white void. Nothing. But humans, being three-dimensional, can stand outside Flatland, look up or down at it, see its inhabitants from an angle they can never have. In fact, we could see inside them, examine their internal organs, reach down and touch a Flatlander's heart or brain with our fingers. In the course of the book, Mr. Square is visited by a being from the third dimension, a sphere. He can move from one place to another without apparently traversing the space between point A and point B. There was also discussion of the possibilities of even higher dimensions, worlds as inscrutable to us as the 3D world was to Mr. Square. I'm no mathematician, but it didn't take an Einstein to infer that the line and the linemen came from one of those theoretical higher planes. The people running the show were not Einstein either. But when they needed expertise, they knew where to go to draft it. Our mathematician's name was Larry Ward. He looked as baffled as I must have looked the day before, and he got no more time to adjust to his new situation than I did. We were all hustled aboard another helicopter and hurried out to the line. I filled him in as best I could on the way out. Again, as soon as we approached the line, a spokesman appeared. He asked us if we'd read the book, though I suspect he already knew we had. It was a creepy feeling to realize he, or something like him, could have been standing, or existing in some direction I couldn't imagine, only inches away from me in my motel bedroom, looking at me read the book, just as the sphere looked down on Mr. A. Square. A flat white plane appeared in the air between us, and geometrical shapes and equations began drawing themselves on it. It just hung there, unsupported. Larry wasn't too flustered by it, nor was I. Against the background of the line, an anti-gravity blackboard seemed almost mundane. The lineman began talking to Larry, and I caught maybe one word in three. Larry seemed to have little trouble with it at first, but after an hour he was sweating, frowning, clearly getting out of his depth. By that time I was feeling quite superfluous, and it was even worse for Lieutenant Evans and his men. We were reduced to following Larry and the line at its glacial but relentless pace. Some of the men took to slipping between the gaps in the line to get in front, then doing all sorts of stupid antics to get a reaction, like tourists trying to rattle the guards at the Tower of London. The lineman took absolutely no notice. Evans didn't seem to care. I suspected he was badly hung over.
"Look at this, Dr. Lewis,"
I turned around and saw that a lineman had appeared behind me in that disconcerting way they had. He had a pale blue sphere cupped in his hands, and in it was a lovely specimen of Papilio zilecheon, the anise swallowtail, with one blue wing and one orange wing. "A gynandromorph," I said immediately, with the spooky feeling that I was back in the lecture hall. "An anomaly that sometimes arises during gametogenesis. One side is male and the other is female."
"How extraordinary. Our leader will be happy to have this creature existing in his palace."
I had no idea how far to believe him. I had been told that at least a dozen motives had been put forward by line spokesmen to various exploratory groups as the rationale for the butterfly harvest. A group in Mexico had been told some substance was to be extracted, harmlessly, so they said, from the specimens. In France, a lepidopterist swore a lineman told her the captives were to be given to fourth-dimensional children as pets. It didn't seem all the stories could be true. Or maybe they could. Step one in dealing with the lineman was to bear in mind that our minds could not contain many concepts that to them were as basic as up and down to us. We had to assume they were speaking baby talk to us. But for an hour we talked butterflies, as Larry got more and more bogged down in a sea of equations, and the troops got progressively more bored. The creatures knew the names of every lepidopteran we encountered that afternoon, something I could not claim. That fact had never made me feel inadequate before. There were around 170,000 species of moth and butterfly so far catalogued, including several thousand in dispute. No one could be expected to know them all. But I was sure the linemen did. Remember, every book in every library was available to them, and they did not have to open them to read them. And time, which I had been told was the fourth dimension, but now learned was only a fourth dimension, almost surely did not pass for them in the same way it passed for us. Larry told me later that a billion years were not a formidable distance for them. They were masters of space, masters of time, and who knew what else? The only emotion any of them had ever expressed was delight at the beauty of the butterflies. They showed no anger or annoyance when shot at with rifles. The bullets went through them harmlessly. Even when assaulted with bombs or artillery rounds, they didn't register any emotion. They simply made the assailants and weapons disappear. It was surmised by those in charge, whoever they were, that these big, noisy displays were dealt with only because they harmed butterflies. The troops had been warned, but there's always some clown. So when an Antaria polyphemus fluttered into the air in front of a private named Paulson, he reached out and grabbed it in his fist. Or tried to. While his hand was still an inch away, he vanished. I don't think any of us quite credited our senses at first. I didn't, and I'd been looking right at him, wondering if I should say something. There was nothing but the polyphemus moth fluttering in the sunshine. But soon enough there were angry shouts. Many of the soldiers unslung their rifles and pointed them at the line. Evans was frantically shouting at them, but now they were angry and frustrated. Several rounds were fired. Larry and I hit the deck as a machine gun started chattering. Looking up carefully, I saw Evans punch the machine gunner and grab the weapon. The firing stopped. There was a moment of stunned silence. I got to my knees and looked at the line. Larry was okay, but the blackboard was gone, and the line moved placidly on. I thought it was all over, and then the screaming began close behind me. I nearly wet myself and turned around quickly. Paulson was behind me, on his knees, hands pressed to his face, screaming his lungs out. But he was changed. His hair was all white, and he'd grown a white beard. He looked 30 years older, maybe 40. I knelt beside him, unsure what to do. His eyes were full of madness, and the name patch sewn on the front of his shirt now read, Nosluap. "They reversed him," Larry said. He couldn't stop pacing. Myself, I'd settled into a fatalistic calm. In the face of what the linemen could do, it seemed pointless to worry much. If I did something to piss them off, then I'd worry. Our Northern California headquarters had completely filled the big Holiday Inn. The army had taken over the whole thing, this bizarre operation gradually getting the encrustation of barnacles any government operation soon acquires, literally hundreds of people bustling about as if they had something important to do. For the life of me, I couldn't see how any of us were needed, except for Larry and a helicopter pilot to get him to the line and back. It seemed obvious that any answers we got would come from him, or someone like him. They certainly wouldn't come from the troops, the tanks, the nuclear missiles I'm sure were targeted on the line, and certainly not from me. But they kept me on, probably because they hadn't yet evolved a procedure to send anybody home. I didn't mind. I could be terrified here just as well as in New York. In the meantime, I was bunking with Larry, who now reached into his pocket and produced a penny. He looked at it and tossed it to me. "I grabbed that when they were going through his pockets," he said. I looked at it. As I expected, Lincoln was looking to the left, and all the inscriptions were reversed.
"How can they do that?" I asked.
He looked confused for a moment, then grabbed a sheet of motel stationery and attacked it with one of the pens in his pocket. I looked over his shoulder as he made a sketch of a man writing L by one hand and R by the other. Then he folded the sheet without creasing it, touching the stick figure to the opposite surface. "Flatland doesn't have to be flat," he said. He traced the stick man onto the new surface, and I saw it was now reversed. "Flatlanders can move through the third dimension without knowing they're doing it. They slide around this curve in their universe. Or a third-dimensional being can lift them up here and set them down here. They've moved without traveling the distance between the two points."
We both studied the drawing solemnly for a moment.
"How is Paulson?" I asked.
"Catatonic. Reversed.
He's left-handed now. His appendectomy scar is on the left. The tattoo on his left shoulder is on the right now."
"He looked older."
"Who can say?
Some are saying he was scared gray. I'm pretty sure he saw things the human eye just isn't meant to see. But I think he's actually older, too. The doctors are still looking him over. It wouldn't be hard for a fourth-dimensional creature to do, age him many years and seconds."
"But why?"
"They didn't hire me to find out why. I'm having enough trouble understanding the how. I figure the why is your department."
He looked at me, but I didn't have anything helpful to offer. But I had a question.
"How is it they're shaped like men?"
"Coincidence," he said, and shook his head. "I don't even know if they is the right pronoun. They might just be one of them, and I don't think it looks anything like us."
He saw my confusion and groped again for an explanation. He picked up another piece of paper, set it on the desk, drew a square on it, put the fingertips of his hand to the paper.
"A Flatlander, Mr. Square, perceives this as five separate entities. See, I can surround him with what he would see as five circles. Now, imagine my hand moving down through the plane of the paper. Four circles soon join together into an elliptical shape, then the fifth one joins too, and he sees a cross-section of my wrist, another circle. Now extend that." He looked thoughtful, then pulled a comb from his back pocket and touched the teeth to the paper surface. "The comb moves through the plane, and each tooth becomes a little circle. I draw the comb through Flatland. Mr. Square sees a row of circles coming toward him."
It was making my head hurt, but I thought I grasped it.
"So they, or it, or whatever is combing the planet, combing out all the butterflies, like a fine tooth comb going through hair, pulling out, what do you call them, lice eggs?"
"Nits." I realized I was scratching my head. I stopped.
"But these aren't circles, they're solid, they look like people."
"Yeah, well, if they're solid, why don't they break tree branches when they go out on them?"
He grabbed the gooseneck lamp on the desk and pointed the light at the wall. Then he laced his hands together.
"You see it on the wall? This isn't the best light."
Then I did see it. He was making a shadow image of a flying bird. Larry was on a roll. He whipped a grease pencil from his pocket and drew a square on the beige wall above the desk. He made the shadow bird again.
"Mr. Square sees a pretty complex shape, but he doesn't know the half of it. Look at my hands, just my hands. Do you see a bird?"
"No," I admitted.
"That's because only one of many possible cross-sections resembles a bird."
He made a dog's head and a monkey. He'd done this before, probably in a lecture hall.
"What I'm saying, whatever it's using, hands, fingers, whatever shapes its actual body can assume in four-space, all we'd ever see is a three-dimensional cross-section of it."
"And that cross-section looks like a man."
"Could be."
But his hands were on his hips now, regarding the square he'd drawn on the wall.
"How can I be sure?"
"I can't. The guys running this show, they want answers, and all we can offer them is possibilities." By the end of the next day, he couldn't even offer them that. I could see he was having tough sledding right from the first. The floating blackboard covered itself with equations again, and the instructor, tutor, translator stood patiently beside it, waiting for Larry to get it, and increasingly he was not. The troops had been kept back, almost a quarter mile behind the line. They were on their best behavior, as that day there was some brass with them. I could see them back there holding binoculars, a few generals and admirals and such. Since no one had told me to do differently, I stayed up at the line near Larry. I wasn't sure why. I was no longer very afraid of the linemen, though the camp had been awash in awful rumors that morning.
It was said that Paulson was not the first man to be returned in a reversed state, but it had been hushed up to prevent panic. I could believe it. The initial panics and riots had died down quite a bit, we'd been told, but millions around the globe were still fleeing before the advancing line. In some places around the globe, feeding those migrant masses was getting to be a problem. And in some places, the moving mob had solved the problem by looting every town they passed through. Some said that Paulson was not the worst that could happen. It was whispered that men had been vanished by the line and returned everted, turned inside out, and still alive, though not for long. Larry wouldn't deny it was possible. But today, Larry wasn't saying much of anything. I watched him for a while, sweating in the sun, writing on the blackboard with a grease pencil, wiping it out, writing again, watching the lineman patiently writing new stuff in symbols that might as well have been Swahili. Then I remembered I had thought of something to ask the night before, lying there listening to Larry snore in the other king-size bed. "Excuse me," I said, and instantly a lineman was standing beside me. "The same one?" I knew the question had little meaning. "Before I asked, why butterflies? You said because they are beautiful."
"The most beautiful things on your planet,"
he corrected. "You're right, but isn't there a second best? Isn't there anything else, anything at all that you're interested in?" I floundered, trying to think of something else that might be worth collecting to an aesthetic sense I could not possibly imagine. "Scarab beetles," I said, sticking to entomology. "Some of them are fabulously beautiful, to humans anyway."
"They are quite beautiful,"
he agreed.
"However, we do not collect them. Our reasons would be difficult to explain."
A diplomatic way of saying humans were blind, deaf, and ignorant, I supposed.
"But yes, in a sense, things are grown on other planets in this solar system, too. We are harvesting them now, in a temporal way of speaking."
Well, this was new. Maybe I could justify my presence here in some small way after all. Maybe I'd finally asked an intelligent question.
"Can you tell me about them?"
"Certainly. Deep in the atmospheres of your four gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, beautiful things have evolved that our leader treasures. On Mercury, creatures of quicksilver inhabit deep caves near the poles. These are being gathered as well. And there are life forms we admire that thrive on very cold planets."
"Gathering cryogenic butterflies on Pluto?" Since he showed me no visual aids, the image would do until something better came along. The lineman didn't elaborate beyond that, and I couldn't think of another question that might be useful. I reported what I had learned at the end of the day. None of the team of expert analysts could think of a reason why this should concern us, but they assured me my findings would be bucked up the chain of command. Nothing ever came of it. The next day they said I could go home, and I was hustled out of California almost as fast as I'd arrived. On my way I met Larry, who looked haunted. We shook hands. "Funny thing," he said. "All our answers, over thousands of years, myths, gods, philosophers, what's it all about? Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where do we go? What are we supposed to do while we're here? What's the meaning of life?" So now we find out. It was never about us at all. The meaning of life is butterflies. He gave me a lopsided grin. "But you knew that all along, didn't you?" Of all the people on the planet, I and a handful of others could make the case that we were most directly affected. Sure, lives were uprooted. Many people died before order was restored. But the linemen were as unobtrusive as they could possibly be, given their mind-numbing task, and things eventually got back to a semblance of normalcy. Some people lost their religious faith, but even more rejected out of hand the proposition that there was no God but the line, so the holy men of the world registered a net gain. But lepidopterists? Let's face it, we were out of a job. I spent my days haunting the dusty back rooms and narrow corridors of the museum, opening cases and drawers, some of which might not have been disturbed for decades. I would stare for hours at the thousands and thousands of preserved moths and butterflies, trying to connect with the childhood fascination that had led to my choice of career. I remembered expeditions to remote corners of the world, miserable, mosquito-bitten, and exhilarated at the same time. I recalled conversations, arguments about this or that taxonomic point. I tried to relive my elation at my first new species, Hypolimnes lewisii. All ashes now, They didn't even look very pretty anymore. On the 28th day of the invasion, a second line appeared on the world's western coasts. By then, the North American line stretched from a point far in the Canadian north through Saskatchewan, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico, reaching the Gulf of Mexico somewhere south of Corpus Christi, Texas. The second line began marching east, finding very few butterflies, but not seeming to mind. It is not in the nature of the governmental mind to simply do nothing when faced with the situation. But most people agreed there was little or nothing to be done. To save face, the military maintained a presence following the line, but they knew better than to do anything. On the 56th day, the third line appeared. Lunar cycle? It appeared so. A famous mathematician claimed he had found an equation describing the Earth-Moon orbital pair in six dimensions, or was it seven? No one cared very much. When the first line reached New York, I was in the specimen halls looking at moths under glass. A handful of linemen appeared, took a quick look around. One looked over my shoulder at the displays for a moment. Then they all went away, in their multidimensional way. And there it is. I don't recall who it was that first suggested that we write it all down, nor can I recall the reason put forward. Like most literate people of the earth, though, I dutifully sat down and wrote my story. I understand many are writing entire biographies, possibly in an attempt to shout out, "I was here!" to an indifferent universe. I have limited myself to events from day one to the present. Perhaps someone else will come by some distant day and read these accounts. Yes, and perhaps the moon is made of green butterflies. It turned out that my question, that last day of my military career, was the key question, but I didn't realize I had been given the answer. The lineman never said they were growing creatures on Pluto. He said there were things they grew on cold planets. After 1 year of combing the earth, the linemen went away as quickly as they had appeared. On the way out, they switched off the light. It was night in New York. From the other side of the planet, the reports came in quickly, and I climbed up to the roof of my building. The moon, which should have been nearing full phase, was a pale ghost and soon became nothing but a black hole in the sky. Another tenant had brought a small TV. An obviously frightened astronomer and a confused news anchor were counting seconds. When they reached zero, a bit over 20 minutes after the events at the Antipodes, Mars began to dim. In 30 seconds, it was invisible. He never mentioned Pluto as their cold planet nursery. In an hour and a half, Jupiter's light failed, then Saturn. When the sun came up in America that day, it looked like a charcoal briquette, red flickerings here and there, and soon not even that. When the clocks and church bells struck noon, the sun was gone. Presently, it began to get cold.
That was U.S. 3 by the composer-arranger-keyboardist James Raymond. Like Shaun Tozer, with whom I began this podcast, James creates soundtrack music for films and TV series. That is, when he's not touring on keyboards with a little group of his dads. The least barbershop of all quartets of all time, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. The piece you just heard was from Greg Hugland's film Surfing Dolphins. And before I go any further, I want to hit you with two very short tracks of James' TV work. First from the CBS series, To Have and to Hold. You can hear quite a bit more of James's work at his newest personal site. This is a complicated URL, so take this down. It's http://web.me.com/jamesdayraymond/hello/music.html. And I hope you're already familiar with the James Raymond music to be found at www.stardancemovie.com, the site for yet another film with James Raymond as its composer. Here's one more chunk of incidental music created by James Raymond for the Lifetime Channel series, Angela's Eyes. Last cut was originally intended to put us all in the proper stormy mood for a rousing reading of my shit-disturbing 1980 essay, Rah-Rah R-A-H. And all of a sudden, well, first of all, I noticed that I'm just about out of time and will not have room for it. Second of all, I'm just not in the mood anymore. Word just now reached me that on New Year's Eve, my favorite writer, Donald Edwin Westlake, died at age 75 while on vacation in Mexico with his beloved wife, Abby Adams. Don wrote over 100 books, specialized in crime fiction and particularly funny crime fiction. He was the funniest son of a bitch that ever put his fingers on a typewriter. And by the way, to his dying day, he wrote on a manual typewriter. He said he didn't want anything humming at him while he was trying to think. Don was born in Brooklyn, New York. He attended the SUNY college system. So did I. He went to Harper and Binghamton. I went to Plattsburgh and Stony Brook. He spent 2 years in the Air Force, and then he started writing. He wrote under his own name, and he wrote under the name Richard Stark, the stories of a man named Parker. He also wrote under the pseudonyms John B. Allen, Judson Jack Carmichael, Kurt Clark, Tucker Coe, Timothy J. Culver, J. Morgan Cunningham, Samuel Holt, a particular favorite of mine, Sheldon Lord, Alan Marshall, and Edwin West. Don was just the best. No one could make me laugh or cry as profoundly as he did. I'm moved on the same level that I was when Robert A. Heinlein had to leave the party.
I'm a little less sure now that I want to live forever if there isn't going to be a new Westlake along every year or two.
Motion pictures made from Don's work include Point Blank, The Hot Rock with Robert Redford, Cops and Robbers, The Outfit, Bank Shot with George C. Scott, Why Me, Payback, and What's the Worst That Could Happen. They tell me that Costa-Gavras adapted The Axe for European screen in 2005. I have not seen it. Jimmy the Kid has been adapted 3 times, it says here in Wikipedia, and Don himself wrote some scripts. His script for the 1990 film The Grifters, adapted from the novel by Jim Thompson, was nominated for an Oscar. As it says here on Wikipedia, Westlake the screenwriter adapted Jim Thompson's work in a straightforward manner, but Westlake the humorist satirized Thompson later that year in the Dortmunder novel Drowned Hopes, which features a character named Tom Jimson, who is hard-boiled to the point of absurdity. Westlake also wrote the original screenplay of The Stepfather, the film of which was sufficiently popular to receive 2 sequels and a forthcoming remake, projects in which he was not involved.
I've just now decided that, totally without permission and purely because I miss him like God damn it to hell already, I'm going to give you an unauthorized reading of the opening chapter of one of his many novels of John Dortmunder and his friends. This one contains one of my favorite opening sentences of all time. This is chapter 1 of Bad News from 2001. John Dortmunder was a man on whom the sun shone only when he needed darkness. Now, like an excessively starry sky, 1,000,000 fluorescent lights in great rows under the metal roof of this huge barn-like store building came flickering and buzzing and squirping on, throwing a great glare over all the goods below, and over Dortmunder, too. And yet he knew this vast speed shop discount store in this vast blacktop shopping mall in deepest New Jersey, very near Mordor, did not open at 2:10 in the morning. That's why he was here. Speed Shop was a great sprawling mass-production retailer, stocked mostly with things that weren't worth more than a quarter and didn't cost more than $4, but it had a few pricier sections as well. There were a pharmacy and a liquor department and a video shop and an appliance showroom. Most important, from John Dortmunder's point of view, there was a camera department, carrying everything from your basic low-price PhD, push here, dummy, to advanced computer-driven machines that chose their own angles. In 2 Speed Shop tote bags, canvas, white, emblazoned in red with the Speed Shop slogan, "Save fast at Speed Shop," Dortmunder could fit $10,000 worth of such high-end cameras, for which he would receive, no questions asked, because the answers are already known, from a fellow in New York named Arnie Albright, $1,000 in cash. 10 minutes inside the store, no more, after he'd bypassed the loading dock alarm systems, and he'd be back in the Honda platoon he'd borrowed 40 minutes ago from an apartment complex further up the highway, and well on his way home to the peace and quiet and safety of New York City. But no. As tote bags full of cameras dangled from his bony hands and he loped down the silent, semi-dark aisles, little night lights here and there guided him along his way, he was suddenly bathed in this ice-water deluge of a harsh, white, fluorescent glare. Okay, there must have been something, some motion sensor or extra alarm he hadn't noticed that had informed on him, and this big store would be filling up right this second with many police officers, plus probably private Speed Shop security people, all of them armed, and all of them looking, though they didn't know it yet, for John Dortmunder. Didn't know it yet, but soon would. What to do? First, drop these bags of cameras behind a kid's sneaker display rack. Second, panic. Well, what else? He'd come in from the loading docks at the back, which they surely knew, so they would come in from the back as well, but they would also come in from the front. And they would leave guards at every entrance, while the rest of them fanned out to search inexorably forward like volunteer Boy Scouts in pursuit of a lost hiker. Any second now, groups of them would appear at the ends of the aisles, visible far away, and he would be just as visible to them. Hide? Where? Nowhere. The shelves were packed full and high. If this were a traditional department store, he could at least try to pretend to be a mannequin in the men's clothing section, but these discount places were too cheap to have full entire mannequins. They had mannequins that consisted of just enough body to drape the displayed clothing on.
pretending to be a headless and armless mannequin was just a little too far beyond Dortmunder's histrionic capabilities. He looked around, hoping at least to see something soft to bang his head against while panicking, and noticed he was just one aisle over from the little line of specialty shops, the pharmacy and the hair salon and the video rental and the optician. The optician. Could this possibly be a plan that had suddenly blossomed like a cold sore in Dortmunder's brain? Probably not, but it would have to do. As the individual all those legislators most specifically had in mind when they enacted their three-strikes-you're-out life imprisonment laws, Dortmunder felt that any plan, however loosely based it together, had to be better than simple surrender. His wallet tonight contained several dubious IDs, including somebody's credit card, so for almost the first time in his life, he made use of a credit card in a discount store, swiping it down the line between door and jamb leading to the optician's office, forcing the striker back far enough so that he could push open the glass door in the glass wall and enter. It wasn't until after the door snicked shut again behind him that he realized there were no knobs or latches on its inside. This door could only be opened or closed or locked or unlocked from the outside, because the fire laws required it to be propped open any time the place was open for business. Trapped, he thought. But then he thought, wait a second. This just adds, what do you call it? Verisimilitude. Unless that's the color. The optician's shop was broad and narrow, with the front glass wall facing the rest of Speed Shop, plus white walls at sides and back, liberally decorated with mirrors and with color photographs of handsome people with bad eyesight. A glass counter and display case full of spectacle frames faced the door, and little fitting tables with mirrors and chairs stood to both sides. Against each side wall was a small settee where customers could sit and wait for their prescriptions to be filled, with magazines stacked on a nearby table. The light in here at this time of night was only the long, dim bulbs inside the display racks, mostly showing the frames on the glass shelves. Dortmunder dashed around the end of the counter and found the cash register, which for once he didn't want. But under it was the credit card swiper, which he did want. He found the blank receipts, swiped one with the credit card he'd used on the door, filled in the receipt with some stuff, $139.98, that seemed like a good number, looked at the name on the credit card, and signed it more or less the way it looked on the back. Austin Humboldt. Customer copy, customer copy, here it is. Glancing at the windows across the way, no cops out there yet, he pocketed the customer copy, found the stack of used receipts under the cash register, and added Austin Humboldt's near to but not at the top of the pile. Out of his wallet and into his shoes went all the IDs not named Humboldt. Then he started around the counter again. Wait a minute, if he was buying glasses, he was somebody who'd wear glasses, right? A display on the rear wall was two-thirds full of glasses. He grabbed a pair at random, slapped them on, and realized he was looking through nothing. No glass, just frames. Try it? No, up close it would be obvious, and he had the feeling he'd be inspected up close very soon now. Time, time, time. There was no time for all this. Down to his left, another display of glasses, and these bounced dim light at him from 100 lenses. He lunged down there, praying they wouldn't be blind as a bat prescription specs, threw on a pair of delicate but manly tortoiseshell frames, and looked through glass. Clear glass, clear! Okay! Now he could run around the counter, collapse onto the nearest settee, it wasn't very comfortable, grab a 3-month-old people from the little table, open it, face down on his lap, and flop, eyes closed. It took them 3 minutes to find him. He slumped there, unmoving, telling himself to relax, telling himself if worse came to worst, he could probably eventually escape from prison, and then he heard the rattling of the metal knob on the glass door. Don't react, he told himself. Not yet. It's too soon. You need your sleep. Banging and knocking on the glass door and the plate glass wall. Indistinct, muffled shouting. Dortmunder started, like a horse hearing a pistol shot, and stared around the optician's shop at the magazine sliding off his lap, and at last at the glass wall, which had become an active mural of cops peering in at him, staring, pressing faces to the glass, waving and yelling, a horrible sight. And now he realized these glasses he'd put on were not exactly clear lenses, not exactly. They were some kind of magnifiers, reading glasses or whatever, which made everything just a little larger than usual, a little closer than usual. He not only had this horrible mural of your police in action in front of him, he had them in his lap. Too late to change. Just stagger forward and hope for the best. He jumped to his feet. He ran to the door, reaching for the non-existent knob, bruising his knuckles against the chrome frame surrounding the glass, because it wasn't exactly where he saw it, then licked his knuckles. Cops crowded close out there, the other side of the glass, calling, intensely staring. Dortmunder stopped licking his knuckle to show them his most baffled face. He spread his hands, then pointed at the door, then made a knob-turning gesture, then shrugged like Atlas with an itch. They didn't get it yet. They kept yelling at him to open up. They kept pointing at the door as though he didn't know where it was. He did his little repertoire of gestures some more, and then two of them, one at the door and one at the wall next to the door, pressed their faces to the glass so that they now looked like fish in police uniforms, and squinted to try to see the inside of the door. Now they got it. And now Dortmunder, once they understood he was locked in here, "It's a locked room mystery," began to exhibit signs of panic. He'd been feeling panic all along. It was nice to be able to show it, even though under false colors. He bobbed back and forth along the wall, waving frantically, gesturing with great urgency that they should release him. He pointed at his watch. "Do you people realize what time it is?" He mimed making rapid phone calls. "I got responsibilities at home." He tried to tear his hair, but it was too wispy to get a grip on. Now that he was excited, the cops all became calm. They patted the air at him. They nodded. They made walkie-talkie calls. They came close to the glass to mouth, "Take it easy." Easy for them to say. It took them 15 minutes to unlock the door. Apparently, none of them was a good credit risk. While more and more of them, cops and rent-a-cops both, came streaming in from all the aisles of Speed Shop to stare into this one-man zoo, Dortmunder kept raving and ranting in pantomime, flinging his arms about, stomping back and forth. He even ran around behind the counter and found the phone, intending to call his faithful companion, May, sleeping peacefully at home in their nice little apartment on West 19th Street. Would he ever see it again? Just so the cops could see the frantic husband was calling his worried wife. But a recorded announcement told him he could make only local calls from that phone, which was even better. Let May sleep. At last, another team of cops arrived with special vinyl jackets in dark blue to show they were super cops and not just trash cops like these other guys and gals, and they had several strange narrow metal tools with which they had at the door. God, they were slow. Dortmunder was just looking around for a helpful brick when at last the door did pop open and maybe 20 of them came crowding in. "I gotta call my wife!" Dortmunder yelled, but everybody else was yelling too, so nobody could hear anybody. But then it turned out there actually was someone in authority, a gruff, pot-bellied older guy in a different kind of important uniform, like a blue army captain, who roared over everybody else, "That's enough! Pipe down!" They piped down, surprisingly enough, all of them except Dortmunder, who in the sudden silence once again shouted, "I gotta call my wife!" The man in charge stood in front of Dortmunder as though he were imitating a slammed door.
"Name," he said.
"Name? What was that name?" "Austin Humboldt," Dortmunder said.
"You got identification?"
"Oh, sure." Dortmunder pulled out his wallet, nervously dropped it on the floor. He didn't have to pretend nervousness, not at all. Picked it up and handed it to the boss cop, saying, "Here it is, you look at it. I'm too jumpy. My fingers aren't working." The cop didn't like handling this wallet, but he took it, opened it up, and then spent a couple of minutes looking at several documents the real Austin Humboldt would be reporting stolen 6 hours from now. Then, handing the wallet back, waiting while Dortmunder dropped it again and picked it up again and returned it to his pocket, he said,
"You broke into this building half an hour ago, came in here, got locked in. What were you after?"
Dortmunder gaped at him.
"What?"
"What were you after in this shop?" the cop demanded.
Dortmunder stared around at all the displayed eyeglass frames.
"My glasses!"
"You break into a store?"
"I didn't break in!"
The cop gave him a jaundiced look. "The loading dock just happened to be open." Dortmunder shook his head, a man besieged by gnats.
"What loading dock?"
"You came in through the loading dock."
"I did not!"
Another look. "Okay," the cop decided. "Suppose you tell me what happened." Dortmunder rubbed his brow. He scuffed his shoes on the industrial carpet. He stared at his feet.
"I don't know what happened," he said. "I must have fell asleep."
A different cop said, "Captain, he was asleep when we got here." He pointed at the settee. "Over there."
"That's right," said several of the cops. "Right over there."
They all pointed at the settee. Outside the plate glass, some of the other cops pointed at the settee, too, without knowing why. The captain didn't like this at all.
"Asleep? You broke in here to sleep?"
"Why do you keep saying,"
Dortmunder answered, drawing himself up with what was supposed to be an honest citizen's dignity,
"I broke in here."
"Then what did you do?" the captain demanded.
I came in to get my prescription reading glasses, Dortmunder told him. I paid for them with a credit card, two pair of sunglasses and regular, and they told me to sit over there and wait. I must have fell asleep, but how come they didn't tell me when my glasses were ready?
Looking around as if suddenly realizing the enormity of it all, he cried,
They left me here! They walked out and locked me in and left me here! I could have starved!
The captain, sounding disgusted, said, No, you couldn't have starved. They're going to open up again in the morning. You can't starve overnight.
I could get damn hungry, Dortmunder told him. In fact, I am damn hungry. I never had my dinner.
Struck by another thought, he cried,
My wife is going to kill me. I'm this late for dinner.
The captain reared back to study his prisoner. Let me get this straight, he said. You came in here earlier today,
around 4 this afternoon, yesterday afternoon.
You bought two pairs of glasses, you fell asleep, and you want me to believe the staff left without seeing you and locked you in, and it was just coincidence that somebody else broke into this building tonight?
Somebody broke in?
Nobody answered. They all just kept looking at him, looming outside these glasses. So finally Dortmunder said,
How often does that happen? Somebody breaks in here.
The captain didn't deign to answer. Dortmunder looked around, and another younger cop said,
Not a lot.
But he sounded defensive.
Well, so it happens, Dortmunder said.
Sometimes,
the younger cop admitted, while the captain glowered at this underling, not pleased. Dortmunder spread his hands.
So what kind of coincidence is that?
The captain leaned closer. Now the glasses made him look like a tank with eyes.
How did you pay for these glasses? Cash?
Of course not.
Now the damn glasses slipped down his nose, and he finger-pushed them back a little too hard.
Ow!
Blinking, eyes watering, which didn't help.
I used my credit card, he said.
So the receipt should still be here, shouldn't it?
I don't know.
Let's just see, the captain said, and turned to one of his flunky cops to say, Look for it, the credit card slip.
Yes, sir.
Which took about a minute and a half.
Here it is,
said the cop, pulling it out of the stack he'd placed on the counter. In stunned disbelief, the captain said,
There's a credit card slip there?
Yes, sir.
Dortmunder, trying to be helpful, said,
I got my copy in my pocket if you want to see it.
The captain studied Dortmunder.
You mean you really did come in here this afternoon and fall asleep?
Yes, sir,
Dortmunder said. The captain looked angry and bewildered.
It can't be, he insisted. In that case, where's the burglar? He has to be in the building.
One of the rent-a-cops, an older guy with his own special uniform with stripes and epaulets and stars and awards and things on it to show he was an important rent-a-cop, a senior rent-a-cop, cleared his throat very loudly and said,
Captain?
The captain lowered an eyebrow at him.
Yeah? The word went out, the senior rent-a-cop said, that the burglar was caught.
The captain got that message right away.
You're telling me, he said, no one's watching the exits. Well, the word was, the senior rent-a-cop said, he was, you know, caught.
Dortmunder, honest but humble, said,
Captain, would you mind? My wife's going to be really, really, really irritated. I mean, she doesn't like me to be 10 minutes late for dinner, you know?
The captain, furious at everybody now, snapped, What? What do you want?
Sir, Dortmunder said, could you give me a note for my wife?
A note?
The captain looked ready to punch a whole lot of people, starting with Dortmunder.
Get out of here!
Well, okay,
Dortmunder said.
That was the opening chapter of Bad News. I never met Don's face once, though not for lack of trying. We once missed each other by only an hour. We were mail and later email friends only. I don't have a single Westlake autograph except on short notes he snail-mailed. I've never laid eyes on his wife, Abby. But I have absolutely no doubt that if I am ever afforded that privilege, I will love her on sight. I hope she will forgive my unauthorized reading here. Don's final book will be, appropriately, another Dortmunder novel called Get Real, in which Dortmunder's gang apparently intersect with reality television, which deserves it. It is due out next July, and can be pre-ordered right now from the Amazon. I recommend it and everything ever written by Donald Westlake as highly as I possibly can. Thank you all for the kind and generous Christmas and New Year's donations, subscription fees, and recipes sent to SpiderRobinson.com. I'm sorry the holidays and illness have made me even slower than usual in answering your emails. Please come back in a couple of weeks for Spider on the Web number 62. Just to remind you, as always, this podcast is issued under a Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. I feel a natural inclination to end this pod with something mournful in Don's honor, but I know he'd never forgive me if it wasn't something at least a little ridiculous, too. Don was a New Yorker through and through, to his bones, and this song pokes the gentlest fun imaginable at neighboring New Jersey, a favorite pastime of all New Yorkers, by simply listing the names of some of its more colorful cities and towns. I do know that my friend Lawrence Block was a close friend of the late great Dave Van Ronk, the mayor of McDougal Street, and Larry and Don were friends of old, so I'm going to presume Don knew and loved Dave as well. Here to play us out is a track from a hopelessly out-of-print album called Going Back to Brooklyn, Mayor Van Ronk's Garden State Rag. Take us home, Professor.
Sucker soon a man a muskin plum sock by Val Buck shoot him turkey foot McKenna Pog jump down feeble town yummies down Rawway. Wicked tuck man up the junk man to our miss. Manasquan, Raritan, Matawan, Totowa. Whippity, bossippity, bitty, pot, Hackensack, Bats, Toe, Nesco, Matita, Con, Peapack, Lock, Arbor, Egg, Arbor, Swinesburg, Caviar. Tenafly Net Kong Wat Chung put him in Mount Misery Bardonia Ironia Colonia Wee Hawking Minnehawken Mantle Looking Mahalala Peace Hawking Ducktown Iron Man Freeling Eisen Lodi. Double trouble, bigger to the Montague. Luxapana, Canacon, Esplanade, Ocean View. Navisink, Shabakuk, Onsat, Jumbo, Wharton, Bag of Waterwick, Blue Ball, Ringo, Matchaponics, Delawana, Wawa, Yonder.